From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the US prepares to send a team of experts to Nigeria to help with the rescue of over 200 schoolgirls abducted by terrorists.
We remain deeply concerned about the welfare of these young girls, and we want to provide whatever assistance is possible in order to help for their safe return to their families.
Also today, the threat of climate change to the United States is laid bare in an alarming new report. And members of the activist punk band Pussy Riot are in the US Capitol to press lawmakers to do more to protect human rights in Russia.
Political opposition is threatened, intimidated, and arrested. How bloggers are required to register, how the internet is no longer free. And the list goes on and on and on.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The White House says it's sending a team to Nigeria as soon as possible to help in the hunt for the nearly 300 kidnapped teenage girls. Another 8 were reportedly seized on Tuesday by the Islamist group Boko Haram. From Washington, Malcolm Brown reports.
Criticized by civil society groups for failing to respond earlier, now the White House says time is of the essence in the hunt for the kidnapped girls. A team of U.S. military and law enforcement personnel is heading to Nigeria to share intelligence and experience in hostage negotiation with the authorities there. The White House urged the Nigerians to use all available resources to secure the girls' safe return, but the move comes just days after U.S. officials suggested Boko Haram had moved the teenagers beyond Nigeria's borders.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says he and his European counterparts are using lots of energy to find a reasonable way forward in the Ukraine crisis, but said Russia is not helping.
The United States, the EU, and our allies have made our choice very, very clear. We are going to stand together, united, not just in support of Ukraine, but united in support of de-escalating, united in support of a peaceful, diplomatic solution, united in recognition that, yes, there are historic and cultural and other ties between Russia and Ukraine, but the way to assert them is at the diplomatic negotiating table, not at the end of a gun.
He met with EU High Representative Lady Catherine Ashton Tuesday to discuss the crisis in Ukraine, among other issues. Mr. Kerry said further talks will be held next week in London. Meanwhile, Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Moscow is not interested in participating in a second round of international talks on resolving the violence in eastern Ukraine, saying nothing would be achieved there. Speaking during a press conference in Vienna, Mr. Lavrov said Russia is ready to promote peaceful dialogue between the warring sides in Ukraine, but said the U.S. and the EU must also do their part. Speaking through a translator, he said the first step in solving the crisis must be for Ukrainian authorities to stop using force against pro-Moscow militants.
The first and obvious step is to cancel the order to use the army and the National Guard for suppressing protests.
The U.S. has hit 2 individuals linked to the violence on both sides of the conflict in South Sudan with sanctions. The U.S. Treasury Department has announced asset freezes under U.S. jurisdiction and bans those targeted from movement out of the United States. But according to Secretary of State John Kerry, both sides appear to have committed to face-to-face talks in Ethiopia. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Global warming is having a direct impact on Americans. That's the thrust of a major new report on climate change released by the White House. The authors of the 1,100-page report, who include many of America's top scientists, say there's mounting evidence that global warming is causing extreme weather patterns and wreaking havoc on the lives of Americans. From Washington, Nina Maria Potts reports.
The nation's top scientists are taking on the skeptics. In a major new federal report on climate change, the authors of the massive document say the evidence is undeniable and that the planet is warming because of human activity, pointing to an increase of extreme weather events over the past 50 years. The National Climate Assessment is the most comprehensive U.S. climate change report ever produced. It says global warming is hitting infrastructure through sea level rises, extreme downpours, and rising temperatures.
Japan has signed a security partnership with NATO that will see their militaries work more closely together to fight piracy and terrorism. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe signed the deal at NATO headquarters in Brussels, where Secretary General Rasmussen said the two sides were natural partners when it came to securing sea routes. The entertainer Rolf Harris has arrived in court in London to face trial over 12 counts of indecent assault. The 84-year-old arrived with his wife Alwyn Hughes and his security team. UK correspondent Dan Whitehead has more.
Rolf Harris is accused of assaulting four girls, the youngest of whom was 7 or 8 at the time of the alleged attacks, between 1968 and 1986. Mr. Harris entered not guilty pleas to the charges at a hearing back in January. A jury for the trial is expected to be selected on Tuesday, with the prosecution opening its case later this week. The trial is expected to last for 6 weeks.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The United States is sending a team, including military and law enforcement personnel, to help secure the safe return of over 200 schoolgirls kidnapped in Nigeria.
Our embassy in Abuja is prepared to form a coordination cell that could provide expertise on intelligence, investigations, and hostage negotiations, and to help facilitate information sharing and victim assistance. We remain deeply concerned about the welfare of these young girls, and we want to provide whatever assistance is possible in order to help for their safe return to their families.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry today, 3 weeks after the mass abduction by Islamist extremists Boko Haram. Protesters gathered outside the Nigerian embassy in Washington, D.C. to call for the international community to help in reuniting the young girls with their families. The teenagers were taken from a school in the northern state of Borno on April 14th. A militant leader claims the kidnappers intend to sell the girls, most of whom are between 16 and 18 years old. The White House announcement comes amid new reports that more schoolgirls were kidnapped by armed militia on Monday. For more, I spoke to our Africa correspondent, Gary Alfonso.
Near the very hilly Gwoza area, which is Boko Haram's main base, and basically asked these girls to get onto vehicles that were painted in military or army colors. They started shooting wildly throughout the village and then exited the village with the girls on board. And those girls have not been seen since.
Perhaps the US and the international community was slightly slow to engage in the severity of this mass abduction. But the same criticism could be levelled at the Nigerian government.
Absolutely. Only 2 days ago, the President Goodluck Jonathan in Nigeria has finally pledged that everything will be done and that the army and the military are going to not only pull out all stops to get to those areas in order to try and retrieve the girls that were taken, but also said that they are now calling on international assistance. And 3 weeks after the fact, absolutely amazing that the Nigerian government has taken so long to try and get some kind of reaction from the international community, because the outcry has been there from day one, but it seems that there are very deep-rooted political conflicts, not only between the ruling party in Nigeria and some of the more Islamic parties in the north, and obviously the Christian and Muslim party divide in Nigeria is almost 50-50. So there are very, very deep-rooted suspicions among political parties and also among the different groups in the north and in the south about the motives of just about anybody involved in anything that has a political motive. So that might have been the reason for the very slow uptake. But the president now saying that the army is going to do what they can, but calling on international assistance, because there is one thing is there is no doubt over, and that is that these girls were taken to strongholds of this Boko Haram Islamic group within Chad and Niger and northern Cameroon. Now, those are three states that are part of the international community, and obviously, if these girls have been kidnapped and taken there, the Nigerian outcry only 3 weeks later really begs some serious questions from a diplomatic view as well.
FSN's Africa correspondent, Gary Alfonso. And for more on the US reaction to the mass abduction, I spoke to Malika Saada Sarr, Executive Director of the Human Rights Project for Girls.
I'm disappointed that it has taken the administration as well as the international community so long to respond to this crisis that is 3 weeks old. And I think there's a real question of whether this is too little too late, and my confusion as to why this outrage did not take place as soon as the girls had been abducted from their school.
So if I was to ask you to draw a conclusion of your own, why has the uptake on this story, the significance and an alarm, been so muted in terms of an international response?
I am still grappling with that question. I don't understand the disparity between how the international community organized around Malala's attempted assassination because she chose to go to school, and the absolute silence of the international community up until recently because 276 girls also insisted on going to get an education to go to school, and as a result of that were purposely targeted and abducted.
The United States considers Boko Haram as a terrorist organization. They've suggested, on top of expressing their outrage at the situation, that they might actually lend a hand here and try and help. Do we have any idea of what form that assistance might take?
What I have heard so far sounds very vague to me, and certainly it's not enough for one country to step up. This really has to be about an international partnership, as we've seen in so many other examples when there is an international crisis.
Malika Saada Sarr, Executive Director for the Human Rights Project for Girls. This is FSN Reports. Now, rising sea levels, wildfires and drought, just some of the present-day dangers facing the United States thanks to climate change. That's according to a new White House report. The findings warn about an increase in extreme weather events, fires, floods and downpours, with experts hoping the report will bolster the Obama administration's commitment to addressing climate change. Dr. Susan Moser is one of the 300 experts who put the report together, and she spoke to me earlier.
We have seen more extreme heat events that last longer, are more intense. We're seeing more heavy rainfall events, heavy downpours, particularly in the northeast of this country, where there has been more than a 70% increase in those types of events in the last 50 years. And then all around the country, we are seeing our oceans rise. And those three, I would say, are among my most, the kinds of things that keep me up at night.
And do you expect this report and the findings within it to have a catalytic effect, perhaps, on government attitudes and action towards dealing with these problems?
Well, we obviously we've done our best, if you will, to tell a compelling story, one that highlights how much we are already seeing the impacts happening right now, how serious they could become if we do not take action, the many opportunities that we have to actually do something about it, both on reducing the emission side, reducing the causes, and then dealing with it. And it's my sense that when Americans are faced with it's a present clear danger and there are things we can do, that they are actually far more likely than they have been in the past to demand of their political representatives action on this problem.
Do you think that message is getting across? You talk about communicating these problems to the wider public, and I suppose part of the job of the administration is taking the expert findings from yourself and your colleagues and actually making them accessible to the wider population. Do you think that's being achieved?
I have been part of the first assessment. I was not part of the second assessment, and I'm part of the third assessment. I would say we have done a better job to write a more comprehensive report with more things that Americans really care about, really making it accessible both online, through the web, with social media, and in accessible language, that I think we've done you know, 90% of, we've carried that ball, if you will, 90% down the field.
Right.
Now, of course, you know, we need people who will take this information and carry it further to their communities. In fact, I want to point you to something that you might find interesting in this regard. Over the last 4 years, we have partnered with more than 100 organizations in something called NCANet. It's a network of networks, essentially, of organizations that are not part of this effort, per se, but who find it really interesting and see the relevance of this report to their members, to their stakeholders. And as we speak right now, they're in the business and they're in the, you know, helping, if you will, to magnify the impact of this report being released today.
There's a sense, isn't there, from this report that the issues of climate change have actually arrived on American shores. What do you think in particular over the last 10 years Americans have taken note of in terms of climate change impacting their daily lives?
Whether you're a farmer in the Midwest and you're going through one of the worst droughts in decades, or you know, whether you're in New York City or on the East Coast and you experienced Sandy, or whether you went through Hurricane Irene just a year before that, or whether you're, you know, right now in California and going through one of the biggest droughts we've had on record in many decades. It's made worse by the fact that there are now twice as many Californians drawing on the water.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're in, you know, in any of those regions, you are experiencing extremes right now. You know, they play out differently across the region. But no matter where you are, you will have been touched by these extremes. And I think what we're seeing is that, you know, for all these years we've been talking about, you know, all these different dots of data points, if you will, mm-hmm. people are now beginning to connect these dots.
Do you think they're adapting?
We're seeing more activity. I would say, you know, adaptation is one of the issues that I am working on and have been working on for 20 years. When I started 20 years ago, people were essentially just, you know, looking at me as if I was a, you know, deer in headlight or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just couldn't relate to what I was talking about. And now you go in pretty much any community in this country and people are beginning to realize climate change is here.
President Obama is doing his bit today as well. He'll be talking to weather forecasters. Do you think that's a good idea, considering that among those ranks, you do have some who are skeptical of climate change?
No, if you look at the average American and they're, after they leave high school, how many times they touch in with science, the number one area in which they actually still have some connection with science is on the weather news at night.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So if there is one place you want to reach people, it's through the evening news, especially for weather. And so weather forecasters are absolutely critical communicators on these issues. They have been skeptical over the years, and the longer I've been working with them, the longer I hear them talking on TV, the more I see them realizing that in those areas where they are, things are strange too. Weird things are happening. Trends are outside the box that they've known for many, many years. So I think they are a critical magnifier of you know, just reaching the American public. They're the microphone on this issue. So I think it's a really good idea.
Now, members of the activist punk band Pussy Riot came to the US Capitol today to press lawmakers to do more to protect human rights in Russia. Nadia Tolokonikova and Maria Alyokina, who goes by Masha, came with a list of more than a dozen Russian officials they want American lawmakers to sanction by freezing their overseas assets and blocking their travel to the United States. Our Capitol Hill correspondent Alice Olstein reports that as some Congress members push forward on these sanctions, others are questioning their effectiveness.
With official Washington's attention focused on Russia's actions in neighboring Ukraine, two of the country's most famous dissidents visited the U.S. Congress and asked them not to forget about human rights within Russia. Activist musicians Nadia Tolokonikova and Maria Alyokina, who spent time in Russian prisons and labor camps in 2012, met with members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on Tuesday to report on conditions on the ground. Maryland Democrat Ben Cardin told reporters the testimony of the two women is crucial for determining policy decisions going forward.
We heard firsthand from members of the Pussy Riot as to the circumstances in Russia as it relates to the LGBT community, as it relates to how NGOs are restricted, how political opposition is threatened, intimidated, and arrested, how bloggers are required to register, how the internet is no longer free, and the list goes on and on and on as to the circumstances currently in Russia.
Though some foreign policy experts and some of his own colleagues have questioned whether sanctions are having an impact on Russia, as the Putin government has not drastically changed course, Cardin defended the tactic.
We think it does work. We see Russia's reaction to it, which has been pretty strong, which indicates that the Russian elite, which are very close to Mr. Putin, are very much impacted by what we're doing. We do believe that a large part of the reason why there is corruption in Russia is that they use the corrupt resources to buy assets in America. They use it to travel to America. And by denying that, we make it clear that we will not be a participant in these illegal gains.
Cardin has been pushing in particular for an expansion of the 2012 human rights law called the Magnitsky Act, which allows for sanctions against individuals in Russia found guilty of human rights violations. The Pussy Riot band members came Tuesday with a list of 16 such individuals, including police officers, judges, and prison officials, who they say should be added to that list. Nadia Tolokonikova speaking through an interpreter.
One of the people whom you see on this list, whom you see on the first page of this list, is Vladimir Kolokoltsev. Presently, he's the Minister of the Interior of the Russian Federation, head of the Russian police. And among other things, he's also complicit in issuing an order which denies the right of ordinary Russian policemen to travel abroad. And ordinary Russian policemen and members of Russia's police force themselves believe that this is a violation of their rights as well.
Dressed in a black miniskirt and wearing glasses with thick blue frames, her bandmate Masha Alyokhina said the list includes officials who have helped arrest and sentence anti-Putin demonstrators and environmental activists over the past year.
We have to talk about these people and we have to talk about our political prisoners, because if we know that silence is the most dangerous thing for a political prisoner, and if we allow these people to be forgotten, that they might easily be killed.
At Tuesday's press conference, Masha and Nadia also went off script and called out human rights violations in the United States. Specifically, a trial verdict Monday finding an Occupy activist guilty of assaulting a police officer.
Yesterday, we found out that Manhattan City Court has sent to prison one of the Occupy Wall Street protesters, Cecily McMillan, and we were quite appalled and saddened to hear about that. We have sympathy for the Occupy Wall Street movement, and we really honestly do believe that no country should ever have political prisons.
McMillan, whose sentencing hearing is scheduled for May 19th, faces up to 7 years in jail. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Finally tonight, FSN Spotlight, our new segment taking an in-depth look at a story you might have missed. With today's edition, Simon Marks.
On FSN Spotlight today, a new portrayal of a much-discussed US president. The actor Bryan Cranston, best known for playing the character Walter White on the AMC drama Breaking Bad, is now appearing on Broadway as Lyndon Baines Johnson. In the Broadway show All the Way, he explores President Johnson's first year in office following the tumultuous November 1963 assassination of John F. Kennedy. The PBS NewsHour's Jeffrey Brown spoke to Bryan Cranston for a segment that aired on the program last weekend.
This is the most important election of your lifetime, and the choices couldn't be clearer.
Lyndon Johnson, ambitious, impatient, tortured and troubled in a million different ways, all captured by actor Bryan Cranston.
This ain't about the Constitution. This is about those who got more, wanting to hang on to what they got.
The play called All the Way opened on Broadway in March. Written by Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Robert Schenken, it's a look back at the year 1964. President Johnson's first year in office after the assassination of John F. Kennedy. A tumultuous time for the presidency and the entire nation.
We got people in this country living in unbelievable poverty. I know. I grew up like that in the hill country.
I saw you last night, and I saw this character, you know, neck out, shoulders up.
That was my version of LBJ. I mean, it really is a version of him, because you don't want to try to take on the character specifically in the sense that to do an impersonation. You know, I just want to get the sense of who he is and allow that the character just to be absorbed into me, you know, and so I'm able to then let him loose on stage.
Cranston said he prepared for the role by visiting Johnson's presidential library in Austin and reading from the many books written on him. He also listened to some of the former president's recorded phone conversations.
You and I are buddies now, and you understand politics, and I do too, and I'm telling you that we're working with the Republicans up there 100%.
What do you think of this civil rights bill of mine?
Much of the play focuses on the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, part of Johnson's legacy of legislative achievement that's being remembered and celebrated now, 50 years later, and before he was worn down and, for many, tarnished by the Vietnam War.
Do you feel yourself part of that, looking back at the legacy and therefore some responsibility to telling that history?
Well, there's a certain amount of ownership that happens when you take on a character. You absorb as much source material as you possibly can. It's like you're making a bouquet. You're taking bits and pieces from each material that resonate with you, and you're crafting your own LBJ or whomever that character would be.
That resonate with you in some way. Yeah. What does that mean?
Well, knowing that I physically have to be up on that stage and presenting this text, as it were, you take bits and pieces of information that make sense to you, that make you realize, oh, there's interesting things. For instance, I don't even know where I read it, but he had a standing appointment to get a massage every night at the White House. And he called it a rub down. He'd get himself a rub down. And that informed a couple things. I said, he must have been tightly wound. And so I gave him a back issue in the play.
Are you saying?
Indeed, the physical transformation Cranston goes through is striking. Back bent, shoulders hunched, face scrunched, as Johnson cajoles, sweet talks, and threatens legislators to get his way, the famous Johnson treatment. As here with his future vice president, Hubert Humphrey.
This is about votes. You know that's a problem with you liberals. You don't know how to fight. You want to get something done in the real world, Hubert, you're going to have to get your hands wet. Now you call yourself the leader of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party and show me some goddamn leadership.
You're doing that, you know, towering, looking down. And yeah. Is that fun to do?
It's a lot of fun to do.
Is it?
Sure. Anytime a man could boastfully be intimidating, yeah. You know, that's fun to do.
That's actor Bryan Cranston talking to Jeffrey Brown on the PBS NewsHour. And you can watch that segment and see Bryan Cranston in action by visiting the NewsHour's website, pbs.org/newshour. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. Coming up on Wednesday, why the World Health Organization has declared the spread of polio an international public health emergency. That's Wednesday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone, with feature story news everywhere. Have a great evening. Goodbye.